Hello there. Today is Monday, February 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with impeachment behind him, how will President Trump navigate his relationship with Congress?
I think you'd have to conclude from this episode that we won and they lost.
The latest on the coronavirus as China reports less new cases. Also ahead, musicians from around the world hold a 10-hour benefit to concert to support Australia's deadly bushfire recovery. It's all on today's International Edition. Congressional Democrats have attempted to remove President Donald Trump from office for alleged abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, and that failed in the U.S. Senate earlier this month. But it hasn't stopped House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from criticizing Trump for what she says is a manifesto of untruths. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports on what happens next in the relationship between the White House and Capitol Hill.
For over 3 years, some on Capitol Hill believe no politician battled President Trump more skillfully than House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But after failing to remove the president from office, she faces a decision as her party tries to defeat him in November polls.
I think you'd have to conclude from this episode that we won and they lost.
She can keep up her public opposition to the president, such as when she tore up the speech he delivered to Congress.
The reason it's getting so much attention is that it feels so symbolic to both sides of where we are right now, not because it changed anything.
That approach will draw fire from Republicans and could also be unpopular with voters in an election year.
You know, the Democrats know that Republicans are not going to vote to impeach, barring some economic collapse. So, you know, what would be the purpose? And I think that they realize it would damage them politically, the Democrats.
Even if they can't impeach him again, lawmakers have pledged to continue investigating the president.
Subpoenas are always an option.
A series of pending court decisions involving Trump allies, such as campaign advisor Roger Stone, is likely to keep political tensions high.
This is an abuse of power that the president is again trying to manipulate federal law enforcement to serve his political interest. And the president is what he is. He thinks he's above the law. He has no respect for the rule. But where are the Republicans to speak out on this blatant violation of the rule of law?
Republicans have little incentive to call out the president in an election year, and they won't be helping Democrats' policy initiatives through the chamber controlled by Mitch McConnell.
He's the Grim Reaper. It's a Senate graveyard.
That leaves Pelosi with a familiar option: confronting Trump despite the political risks. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Countries around the world are introducing precautionary measures to prevent the coronavirus from infecting their citizens. Chinese officials Sunday confirming a total of 68,500 confirmed cases and 1,665 deaths from the virus. The number of suspected new cases exceeds 8,000. So far, no one knows when the outbreak may end, while the virus infects more and more people across international borders. VOA's Latika Hoek has this story.
At least 46 American citizens tested positive for coronavirus on the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which has been docked in Japan's Yokohama port since February 5th, with hundreds of infected passengers. The American travelers will have to be treated in Japan before they can return home. Chinese officials said Sunday that more than 9,500 people were cured and discharged from hospitals, and that a number of critically ill people has dropped in February.
Among confirmed cases, critical cases in other provinces in the country was 15.9% at the peak on January 27th and dropped to 7.2% on February 15th. This change shows that the prevention and control on virus is going into effect.
Preventative measures include a tougher control of meat markets to ensure there are no illegal sales of meat or wildlife, and encouraging people to telecommute. The city of Wuhan in Hebei province, where the virus is believed to have originated, has been virtually isolated. Still, the virus continues to spread. Egypt's health ministry on Friday announced the first confirmed case of the novel coronavirus in Africa. Communities around the world are on alert. The Ministry of Health in the Palestinian territory of Gaza has prepared a medical center at the Rafah crossing to test and, if necessary, treat travelers from abroad.
We are now in a quarantine zone that has been prepared to deal with arrivals from China from the moment they leave from China until the end of 14 days, which is supposed to be the incubation period, and thus will be hosted in equipped rooms.
The issue of global threat posed by coronavirus was raised at a security conference in the German city of Munich on Saturday.
The world spends billions of dollars preparing for a terrorist attack, but relatively little preparing for the attack of a virus, which could be far more deadly and far more damaging economically, politically, and socially.
Religious leaders around the world, including in Russia and Israel, have led people in prayer for the end of the virus. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. Former U.S. prosecutors are calling for the U.S. Attorney General's resignation. The UN, United Nations chief, is hailing Pakistan for being the world's second largest host of refugees. An exhibit is remembering the canine contribution to 9/11 rescue efforts. And the early U.S. Democratic presidential caucus voting is starting in Nevada. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. NATO says it will draw down troop levels in Afghanistan if the Taliban shows that it's willing and able to end violence in the country. It follows a tentative deal struck between the U.S. and the Taliban this week. NATO's Secretary General made the comments at the Munich Security Conference in Germany, where world leaders have assembled to discuss the numerous threats facing the world, from conflicts to the coronavirus outbreak. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports from the conference.
Is the West thriving or declining? For the U.S. delegation, the diagnosis was clear.
The West is winning. We are collectively winning. We're doing it together.
Proof, he said, the U.S. troops defending NATO's border with Russia and America's lead role in defeating Islamic State. Pompeo also pledged $1 billion to help Eastern European countries end their dependence on Russian gas, with the aim of boosting U.S. liquefied natural gas exports. Across the Atlantic, the diagnosis appears very different. French President Emmanuel Macron said the U.S. was undergoing a rethink of its relationship with Europe, and the continent must take charge of its own destiny.
15 years ago, we thought our values were universal, that we were going to dominate the world in the long term. And then I look at the horizon of 10 to 15 years, we are going to be increasingly pushed by other agendas and other values. They are emerging.
Macron said it was time to have a strategic dialogue with Russia. Moscow's foreign minister told the conference it was time to abandon the cultivation of the phantom Russian threat. Most European nations say Russia's invasion of Ukraine is evidence of the very real dangers. But it is policy toward China that could emerge as the biggest transatlantic divide. U.S. lawmakers reiterated warnings against allowing Chinese telecoms firm Huawei any role in 5G technology.
This is about choosing autocracy over democracy on the information highway.
This year's focus on cybersecurity saw Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg take the stage amid accusations that social media platforms are facilitating states like Russia and China to interfere in Western democracy.
Frankly, probably all of the internet companies were slow to understanding the kind of information operations that Russia and others were running online. We take down now more than 1 million fake accounts a day across our network.
Conference organizers hailed diplomatic progress in other areas, including a public meeting between the presidents of rivals Azerbaijan and Armenia. There were high-level meetings on Libya and Syria with little tangible progress.
The theme of the conference was meant to be the purported decline of Western democracy amid European fears over strained relations with Washington. The US delegation flatly dismissed those concerns, insisting the West had never been in better health, and left the conference with a clear message that China is adversary number one, and European allies had better wake up to the threat. Henry Ridgwell for VOA News, Munich, Germany.
As more African societies move toward monogamy, family law experts say those who choose plural marriages often lack the support and structures they need. For many in polygamous families today, the cultural landscape has shifted, raising many challenges. VOA's Jesusman Oni has more.
Life is no cakewalk for Jason Asina Agutu as he labors to meet the needs of his two wives and kids.
I lead a struggling life. I go for manual work out there, splitting firewood, clearing sewer lines. I carry luggage for a few coins just to provide for my family.
The Kenyan father of seven juggles his time and resources between his family in the countryside and the other in Nairobi. He regrets not having the money to send his older son to university.
Having two families or two homesteads, people say the individual is capable. But the truth is, he is not managing. It is something that happened without one knowing. You can go somewhere and find someone you can't let go. You made a mistake, and you got yourself into it.
While the number of men taking multiple wives has declined worldwide, polygamous unions remain common in many African societies.
It maintains its popularity in rural areas for the most part, but as Africa becomes a more urbanized society, there's a greater shift toward monogamy in those cities. And that may be largely for economic reasons, that it's more expensive to maintain a large household in a city than it is in a village.
Polygamy has long been a part of traditional or religious customs, predominantly in patriarchies across the continent. In the past, more wives meant more hands for labor, and the number of children that the household had was seen as a strength, says Kenyan family lawyer Judith Wangori.
There was distribution not only of time, of attention, but also even resources that was managed by the customs, by the norms. But also, the girls were brought up to expect that polygamy could happen. The men were also brought up to take in the responsibility that if they choose polygamy, then there are certain responsibilities that go with them.
But with the global rise of monogamy as the dominant marriage institution, the cultural landscape has shifted, raising challenges for those who choose plural marriages today.
People have been brought up with a sense of monogamy in them. They want to own, they want to possess the husband. And then they come into a situation where they probably have to share him with the first family. It's difficult.
Critics say the practice leaves women vulnerable to abuse, neglect, poverty, and household conflict, and can deprive women and children of their marital and inheritance rights. Laws on polygamy vary across Africa, but advocates say legal protection is increasingly more necessary to protect the women and children involved in polygamous unions. Jason Samelny, VOA News.
Almost two decades have passed since the tragedy of September 11th, 2001. The heroic actions of first responders have become the stuff of legends, but one story isn't as well known, the story of the dogs who worked alongside firefighters and rescuers in the rubble of New York City's Twin Towers. A unique exhibit is commemorating those four-legged heroes. Anna Nelson has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
When the tragedy of September 11th, 2001 happened, photographer Charlotte Dumas was far from New York. Yet, she found it impossible not to think about the newspaper pictures showing rescue dogs searching for victims in the rubble of the World Trade Center. 10 years later, in 2011, she decided to create an exhibit dedicated to these four-legged heroes.
They were old. They were like within like 13 to 16 years of age at the time that I photographed them.
Dumas coupled these portraits with the pictures of the same dogs working at the tragedy site, a reminder and an acknowledgement of the brave actions of more than 300 dedicated canine dogs. Cynthia Otto was one of the few veterinarians working with the federal team of first responders. She was responsible for monitoring the dog's workload and making sure they rested in between searches.
People say, were the dogs depressed? Well, probably not, because they didn't understand the loss of life. But what they did understand is that they were trained to find live people that were lost in a collapse, and they weren't finding live people. So they were frustrated. They were not getting the reward. We worked very hard to keep the dogs from having problems and from being sort of burnt out on the work, and they continued to work. We would set up different scenarios so that they could actually find somebody successfully.
When it was clear very few survived the collapse of the Twin Towers, Otto says the dogs somehow knew their task had changed. They started looking for bodies. After the search and rescue operation was over, the dogs didn't have any health issues, unless their human partner did.
If the handler had PTSD-like problems, then the dog also started to show some changes in behavior.
A lot of officers working in the canine unit came to the exhibit opening, with their dogs, of course. The connection between the two is invaluable. These dogs stay with their handlers forever and become part of their family.
The only thing I remember about canine prior to 9/11 was it was a lot smaller, unfortunately. We didn't have as many. You didn't need as many back then. And they were that you didn't see them as much.
The pictures at the exhibit tell different stories, but all of them are about dedication. Dogs' eyes had to be rinsed because of the endless thick dust. Their paws were cut by glass and sharp metal. Yet only one dog died in September 2001, a Labrador named Sirius. A dog run park just minutes from Ground Zero is now named after him. Today, all the dogs who had worked so hard on 9/11 have passed away from old age. But they are still alive in the pictures and in the hearts of thousands of people. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And you are listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's International Edition continues. New cancer treatments have dramatically increased the number of people who have beaten the disease, but the one thing that stands out for many people is having the money to pay for cancer-fighting drugs. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on One American Hospital's efforts to make cancer treatment more affordable.
Medical care in the U.S. costs more than it does in any other developed country.
Breathe in and out.
That means surviving cancer can empty a patient's bank account. When Tori Gaib got her cancer diagnosis, she thought she would be okay financially.
I just went on what they said to do. And at the time, I had really great private insurance.
3 weeks later, her great private insurance stopped covering her medication.
I said, well, how much will this be just to get through for the month? And they said, for the 1 month supply, it's $11,000.
That's about average for new cancer therapy in the U.S., but to make the situation even worse, it was only one of 13 drugs Gaib needed. The astronomical cost of cancer treatment causes many patients in the U.S. to try to save money at the expense of their health.
One in four cancer patients actually report engaging in some risky behavior to try to save on costs, so either skipping refills of medications or even splitting doses.
A financial counselor at the Cancer Center helped Gaib find a way to pay for her treatment.
We've helped over 30,000 patients gain access to grant funding or manufacturer assistance program with a total value of over $500 million.
The hospital also introduced a new program that keeps these expensive medications from going to waste. Patients can now return pills they don't need.
We put that medication into essentially a repository where we wait for the next patient that has a financial need so that we can redispense that medication to another cancer patient.
The program helps patients focus on getting well and not stressing about their finances.
There's so much stress that goes along with this diagnosis, and you really want to try to minimize that stress along with the cancer. And this is one thing that has been given to me that I'm so thankful and grateful for.
Kennerly Shaw says the goal is to start out small and then to expand the program to cover medications for other diseases. Another goal is to provide a model that other institutions can copy so more patients can afford their treatments. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Sonic the Hedgehog opened in first place at the box office this weekend, but Parasite saw one of the largest post-Oscar bumps in years following its Best Picture win. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Parasite has been out for 19 weeks and has also been available on digital platforms.
Is it okay with you?
But it had its biggest weekend yet at the box office.
I'm deadly serious.
Bong Joon-ho's film was the first non-English language film to win Best Picture in the 92-year history of the Academy Awards. So its distributor, Neon, put Parasite into more than 2,000 theaters this weekend. It earned an estimated $5.5 million, the largest Oscars bump for a Best Picture winner since Gladiator in 2001. I'm Ben Thomas.
Musicians from across the world performed in a charity concert in Sydney, Australia Sunday to raise money for bushfire relief. Queen, fronted by Adam Lambert, heated up the bushfire benefit concert Fire Fight Australia, with the band reprising their 1985 Live Aid set. Queen's Brian May also returned to the stage for a show-stopping finale featuring John Farnham's You're the Voice, sung by Farnham, Olivia Newton-John, and Indigenous singer Mitch Tambo, who performed in the Gamilaroi language. Adding to the lineup, Michael Bublé performed from his show in Melbourne, as artists Katie Lang and Ice House performed for more than 70,000 people in Sydney as the concert went into the night and lasted 10 hours. According to organizers, the benefit concert raised $9.5 million, with more donations expected in the coming days. Firefight Australia took place at the ANZ Stadium. Bushfires have ravaged the country for months following a period of extreme heat, lack of rain, and drought, leading to thousands of homes being destroyed, grazing nearly 12 million hectares of tinder dry bushland. 33 people died and an estimated 1 billion native animals were lost. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, and you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.